Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Terry McMillan and John Edgar Wideman. Terry McMillan is the best-selling author of Waiting to Exhale, which gained national attention following its publication in 1992 and was later adapted into a film directed by Forrest Whitaker starring Whitney Houston. Her 1998 novel, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, gained even greater commercial success and was adapted into a film starring Angela Bassett. McMillan is credited with pioneering black urban novels and bringing popular awareness to the existence of an audience eager for novels and movies that feature black middle-class identity. Like McMillan, John Edgar Wideman's novels often focus on black urban life. He spent his first 10 years of his childhood in Homewood, a predominantly black community of Pittsburgh. Homewood became the setting of many of his novels, including Sent for You Yesterday and Philadelphia Fire, which each won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. His memoir, Brothers and Keepers, which examines his relationship with his incarcerated brother, was nominated for a National Book Award. Wideman was the second black American to receive a Rhodes Scholarship to the University of Oxford. He went on to found the African American Studies Department at the University of Pennsylvania and currently serves as a professor at Brown University. Now, from the 1993-94 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Terry McMillan and John Edgar Wideman speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you for sharing your beautiful city with us. This has become a kind of pleasure cruise for me. I've been on programs with Terry before, but we've never done this sort of song and dance team two nights in a row before. So, and I've learned a lot, and it's been quite enjoyable. And thank you for turning out in such generous numbers. It's always a privilege to share something that, and I'll speak for Terry, it's always a pleasure to share something that we love with other people. And writing, after all, is a gift. No, I just said we're very happy to be here and happy to share, and that writing is a gift, and you can take it or leave it. But we're kind of stuck with giving. I think that's the what authors do, what artists do. We're here to talk to you in a kind of relaxed and informal context instead of simply doing a reading. At least that's what we were told. And it's funny because why are we here? We're here because we're both writers. But in this society, if you do something well, the reward is you don't get to do it anymore. Which, well, you can make your own connections. But to warm ourselves up, and I hopefully warm the house up, and start off on our strongest feet, we'd both like to share with you something that we're working on right now. And so without further ado, Madame.
Okay, I just had some Calistoga, so I might burp. John was supposed to tell you what we were supposed to talk about tonight.
If I knew, I would have.
We're going to talk about the differences between men and women. No. We're going to talk about writing. We'll figure it out. Anyway... I know what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about one of the things we're going to talk about is how we make decisions on what we're going to write next, which book we're going to write next. John, of course, is working on a number of books, so he'll probably talk the longest, I hope. I am working on a novel called A Day Late and a Dollar Short. And do you white people know what that means? Do you use that term? You do? that's good.
Do you behave that way?
Day late and a dollar short. Okay. Anyway, we're going to just, let me just read this. This woman, well, her name is Viola, okay, the mother. Can't nobody tell me nothing I don't already know, at least when it comes to my kids. They're all grown, but in a whole lot of ways, they still act like children. I know I get on their nerves, but they get on mine, too. And they're always accusing me of meddling in their business, but hell, I'm their mother. It's my job to meddle. I wouldn't go so far as to call it meddling. What I'd really do is worry about all four of them out loud. If I didn't love them, I wouldn't care what they did or be the least bit concerned about what happens to them, but I do. And sometimes they can't see what they're doing, so I just tell them. Half the time they don't like what I have to say, and half the time they don't listen to me no way. But as their mother, I've always felt that if I don't point out the things they're doing that seem to be causing them problems and pain, who will? Which is exactly how I ended up in this damn hospital. Worrying about kids and husbands. I don't even want to think about Cecil right now because it might just bring on another attack. He's a bad habit I've had for 38 years, which would make him my husband. Between him and the kids, I'm worn out. It's a miracle I can breathe at all. My son Lewis, I'd like to strangle him myself. He is one big ball of confusion, always has had an excuse for everything, and in 34 years, he ain't changed a lick. He even gave himself some kind of incurable disease so he won't have to go back to work no more. Was a highway patrolman for 12 years, and now he goes around telling everybody that he's retired, but all he does is sit up in that little one-bedroom apartment and smoke that reefer, drink 900 ounces of Coke 45s all day long, and complain about his ex-wife, who he ain't been married to now for going on 6 years, but listening to him, you'd swear she just put him out yesterday. He swears up and down he don't love her no more, but let him get a buzz going, and every other word out his mouth is Donetta. Tragedy is his middle name. Whenever he calls me, which is almost always collect, he's got a brand new sob story, and he needs to borrow some money like I got some. For the longest time, I fell for his mess with lending my Mary Kay money, my insurance bill money, even pawn my wedding ring once so he could pay his child support. But then it started to dawn on me that the only time he called is when he wants something. And so last week when he told me his car broke down on the side of the freeway and he needed to borrow $350 until his disability check came, I finally put my foot down and said no. He got mad. You don't care about me, do you, Ma? Don't start that mess with me, Lewis. You don't understand what I'm going through at all. It don't matter whether I understand you or not. I'm your mother, not your woman. Don't you have any friends you can get the money from? If I did, I wouldn't be calling you. All my money is spent, Lewis. He moaned. Can I get 200 then? That's when I slammed the phone down in his face because I couldn't stand listening to him whine like some broken down dog. My hands were shaking so bad and my heart was beating a mile a minute, and I had to reach in the kitchen drawer and grab my spray and take two or three puffs. Seemed like he ain't gonna be satisfied till he used me up. And that's when I started crying, which did me in. So I had to run in the back, sit down on the edge of the bed, get the tube to my machine, and give myself a real breathing treatment. The last thing a grown man should want is pity, especially from his mama. I love him and would give him my last breath, and Lord knows I don't want nothing bad to happen to him. But Lewis got problems I can't help him with. It's some things love can do, and it's some things it can't do. I can't save him. Hell, I'm trying to figure out how to save myself. I swear, it breaks my heart that my own son turned out to be so needy. And he complains about everything, blames everybody for his misery, everybody except Lewis. Let him tell it. The world and everybody in it is out to do him in. Yeah, like this is just one big conspiracy. He says he's a threat to the white man. How? He more of a threat to himself. Let's not kid ourselves. I'm a victim, he says. Yeah, I said, poor planning. How about those two sons you brought into the world and just left them with the mother to fend for on her own, knowing all the lights don't come on in her house? Whose fault is that? She was weird, he said. She was born again is what really happened. Went to the sanctified church and got saved and stopped giving him dessert at night. And, of course, being the fool that he is, it took him 9 years of marriage before he figured out that when she turned everything inside of her over to the Lord, wasn't nothing left for Lewis. I believe in my heart that he drove her towards God, even though I can't figure out for the life of me why she didn't get herself a flesh and blood man, somebody who could at least bring home a paycheck. To tell you the truth, I don't know how Donetta tolerated him for as long as she did. When I left Cecil for the third time, I lived with them for a few weeks, like it drove me crazy. The boys were still in Pampers then, but I had to get out of there, and quick, I couldn't stand it. It was like being in a circus, watching Lewis perform magic tricks that didn't work. He said he was tired of giving people tickets, tired of being at the scene of accidents, so on his off days, he tried to come up with these outlandish money-making schemes that never made him any. Donetta did not know how to keep a house clean, didn't seem to know where to start. I wasted my time trying to show her how to wash clothes so the whites would come out white and not dingy. She didn't know how to measure. And I didn't know what that mess was she called herself cooking. The first thing any mother should teach their daughters is how to operate in the kitchen, because that takes real skill and planning and can help you out in other parts of the house, hell, other parts of your life. I wouldn't exactly give her a high score in the child-rearing department either, but I do give her an E for effort. Since they got divorced, I try to keep in touch with her, but she can't carry on a normal conversation without praising the Lord every other sentence. I ain't got nothing against God. I'm a Christian myself. But my grandson spends too much time in church. I ain't never heard them mention what sports they playing. Normal stuff boys their age should be doing. God could follow them out on a little league field or a basketball court, don't you think? I worry about my grandsons because neither one of their parents got as much sense as a Christmas turkey, and how can you guide a child's life along a safe path when you lost yourself? But maybe all ain't lost. I heard Donetta finally found her real calling. She went to cashier school and is now a checker at Safeway. And she sent me a postcard from a pink hotel in San Diego saying she just got married to somebody from her church and he's got a job and everything. She said he wants to adopt the boys. Lord only knows what's going to happen if and when Lewis finds this mess out. I ain't telling him, that's for damn sure. I don't want to set him off. He should be grateful, though, that some other man is willing to do his job for him. I wonder where my lunch is. My stomach is growling so loud I can hear it. Thank you.
As Terry was saying, I should be saying, what we decided to talk about this evening was our work from the point of view of the writer's workbench. Usually we get asked things like how to stop all the problems in the world, how to bring the guns in from the streets, how to stop the drug menace. Little issues like that. And what we do and what we love to do is write. And so for a while, we're going to focus on that. What do writers do? How do you come up with material? What kinds of choices do you make? What drives us to do what we do? That kind of privileged look, I think it is, because I don't share this with everybody. But that kind of look into the process. And if you are bored with that or don't like it, then you can ask different sorts of questions at the end. But we're going to be writers for a little bit, which does not, of course, exclude political issues. There's nothing more political than a radical act of the imagination. And we can talk about that, too. It's my turn to read from Work in Progress. And after I read, I'll talk a little bit about what I think I'm doing. And then Terry will talk a bit about what she's about these days. I'll read from something that I think is going to be called, the book will be called Father Along.
Father what?
Father Along.
Oh.
There's a hymn called Farther Along, but this is Father Along, one word.
Oh.
And this part is called Picking Up My Father at the Springfield Station. I'm picking him up to take him to my son's wedding. That's the context. On one of my trips to Pittsburgh, he'd said, "See, for once in my life, I wanted to be able to do the things I wanted to do. Not worry about everybody and everything the way your mother does. Worry, worry, worry. I couldn't worry every minute of every day the way she does. I needed some time just to enjoy life, do what I wanted to do, before I got too old and helpless." He'd been frowning, perhaps from the effort of saying the words, turning over memories they freed, both of us very aware of the consequences of his decision to leave his family, the complicated story he'd pared down to a few simple words. Worry included me, my mother, sister, and brothers. We were the flesh and blood stuffed into the words. We had prevented him from enjoying a life of his own. A man with children myself, the first time my father had acknowledged, let alone tried to explain or apologize for deserting his family. The cost of enjoying his life was the price of the ticket. Had been the price of the ticket. Walking out the door had been the price of the ticket.
leaving my mother and the rest of us. He continued to send money, as much whenever he could, to keep us in food and clothes and a roof over our heads, but declared himself gone on his own. His life starkly separate from ours, as clearly defined as certain jarred or foil-wrapped delicacies he ripped off from the fancy parties he served, loot he stashed in the refrigerator. His, our mother warned us, and we better not touch. It better be sitting right there on the shelf for your father when he gets home from work. Not easy now to recall exactly when he did leave. I must have been about 21 when he moved out for good, around the time I had moved out myself for college, the new life it promised. No babies in the house, my youngest sibling, Robbie, 10 or 11. So my father had stuck with us in his fashion for a long time. Difficult now to recall how I felt about his leaving, how the house changed with him not around, because I'd left the house too, and he'd been away in his fashion for most of my life. He floats in and out of the memories of growing up, like memory itself. He remains hauntingly ambiguous, presence and absence, two sides of a coin. And when you toss it to decide what really happened, it often lands standing on edge. Perhaps he had a purpose in waiting so long to speak, waiting till we'd served ourselves from an elaborate breakfast buffet and sat down together in a booth at the Waffle House out on Monroeville Road, waited till I was a father, so when I listened, his words weren't only about him, but about the core of ego, ambivalence, potential for betrayal, hunger for the unknown. Few of us ever quell completely, no matter how character or fate lead us to behave. My father passed the pepper, or the half and half, or whatever, and I understood exactly what he meant. Could not blame, forgive, empathize, exonerate without implicating myself. During our annual or semi-annual visits to Pittsburgh, my wife, kids, and I would stay at my mother's house. Time with my father squeezed in, a few minutes here and there, maybe. Sometimes we'd meet like bachelors, just the two of us, for a drink or a meal on neutral public ground. Time borrowed from our regular lives. Two men, two fathers hooking up, a funny twist on boys' night out, enjoying restaurants, bars, playing free at last while it lasted. I wanted to be able to do the things I wanted to do. A frown had furrowed his forehead, emphasized deep vertical lines from the wings of his nose to his chin, hinging his mouth like a puppet's, flesh showing its age, stretched, pouched, incised, an old man's face finally imprinting my father's flesh, but the eyes ageless elsewhere. His mouth worked, chewing slowly as he always did, slower and longer than anyone else at the family table. Nothing left to chew, you'd think. You'd think he's done and will be excused. And there he goes, twisting his mouth, sucking his cheek, his tongue busy inside his jaw, the inevitable toothpick he produces from nowhere, like a magician to dig out morsels his tongue couldn't budge. While he finished the final stubborn, invisible remnants of his meal that morning in the Waffle House, a certain way he balled up one side of his face, pulled the other cheek taut, and reminded me of one of those maneuvers I learned as a kid, watching him shave. Slipping just inside the bathroom door, if he'd left it open, I'd stand behind him, quiet as the dark face in the mirror. Shaving was a movie of my father. We watched together. Okay to stare, to study him in the mirror, because he was staring and studying too. The face in the mirror, not really my father, it would disappear when he turned his back on it. Sometimes what he did in front of the mirror each morning seemed like fun and games. He'd sing, splash hot water into the sink, whip up lather in a mug with his floppy bristled shaving brush, pat on a foamy white beard, flip his straight razor open like a switchblade, peek at himself, smile, frown, lean in for close-ups till he fashioned just the face he was after. Or the mood could be strictly business, no frills, surly, just finish the job, don't draw blood. Without saying a word, he taught me. Taught the tricks of shaving, the tricks of time. My future lay enfolded within the flat depths of the mirror. One day I would need to do the things he did, know things he knew, not today and not tomorrow exactly, because I already knew them, had already done them. Many faces in the mirror, his, mine, we both saw them, we both could turn away from them, but they'd be there, staring, studying when we looked again, measuring us as we measured them, Part of being a man would be performing daily the rituals I'd learned from the screen where the image of my father's face hovered, dissolving, emerging, doubling, winking at me, ignoring me as steam rose from the sink, misted the glass. In the din and bustle of the restaurant, his mouth had worked intently in its own good time to dislodge hidden bits he needed to chew more. His heavy-lidded eyes, nearly closed, focused inward, distracted by whatever they'd fixed upon, wherever they'd landed, as he recalled his decision to leave his wife and children. In that booth with his grown son, could he see the place he'd glimpsed decades before when he'd decided he must break from his family? Could he visualize again, the world apart he'd been seeking when he'd walked out of the door of the house on Marchant Street, the house I'd left when I went off to college? What had it looked like to him, this elsewhere he was headed towards? Damn the cost. Was it a world where desires could be fulfilled, where grown men could have fun? I had wanted to ask him if he remembered what his vision of his future had been. Ask him if he could describe it. Could he picture it for me now, that shimmering place men and women need to believe in long after they know better? How had it appeared to him 30-some years later, 30-some years ago, when he'd decided to step through the looking glass? And how did it appear that morning, breaking bread together, many years having elapsed, having been what they were, what most people's lives were, if not exactly a tissue of rack and ruin, a colossal morning after mess, the kind he faced after serving one of those sloppy, drunken parties for white people, then had to clean up after everybody leaves, room after nasty room, and you're hungover from bolting good whiskey every chance you've got all night and don't know where to start. You'll never finish clearing away the mess. This is your life, and dawn breaking while we slept at home in our beds. Did I still want to know what he had seen? To be inside him, peering out at a world free of the weight, the burden of me, my siblings, my mother? Was it possible to join him in that alluring, unfallen world, son, father, father, son? Could we meet at last as equals, equally shorn, equally alone, myself unborn or extinguished, out of the way, separate, not a burden to him, myself, nor anyone else, not myself, and him not himself, both of us free as figments of a dream? The story goes, sons kill fathers to become men, assume their rightful place in society. The king is dead. Long live the king. Isn't the other story also always true? Fathers slay sons. Mm. Mm.
You're listening to a talk with Terry McMillan and John Edgard Wideman. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more from McMillan and Wideman is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. This time it's Terry McMillan and John Edgard Wideman in conversation. Let's get back to their conversation from 1994 at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland.
As you might have guessed, I'm writing a book about my daddy. And myself, of course. This book began, for many reasons. One reason is because I've always been both fascinated and frightened by my father's fate. Here's a man, very intelligent, very gifted, a handsome man, physically able, strong, attractive, but yet he lived his whole life under a very low glass ceiling. His life was constricted by the rules of this society, and he knew this from the earliest years, but somehow managed to keep on keeping on. And not only did I wonder about how my father dealt with that kind of constraint and oppression. But I wondered about that whole generation of African-American men. Some of what I felt was admiration, but what I really wanted to know was just how could you take it? How could you take it? And what was most frightening is that I knew that he didn't simply take it, but that there was some cost at some level of his being, of his psyche. And it's that cost that I wondered about, because I knew that cost because it was so deep, and because so much of it had been kept hidden from me, would emerge in me and in my generation. And I wanted to be somehow cued to that. I wanted to be ready for it. I wanted to turn it into something positive. Another thing I thought about that his generation of men is that I owed him something. I owed them something. But not simply making more money or getting more prestige or bringing him out to see my daughter play basketball at Stanford for a weekend. I owed them something that I couldn't really be sure of until I got to know them. But I didn't know them, and that was the problem. I have a very loving relationship with my father. This is not I thought at first it might be a dramatic book. Father, son, many, many years of distance and not knowing one another, and boom, something dramatic and, you know, a big scene, Hollywood. I got to know my father, or whatever. It didn't happen that way. The more I looked, the more I realized that I had a very ordinary relationship, and that lots of the things I felt were strange about my relationship with my father were things that were shared by my peers and their relationships with their dads, black and white. So that was kind of a revelation at the beginning and throughout the writing. What I learned is that it was going to be much harder than that, because our relationship was ordinary. I was sure he loved me to the extent that he understood and could practice that word, and I certainly care about him. But damn it, we really just never talked. Just never talked. And could go years with just these little visits in Pittsburgh. And those were frustrating because of the circumstances. Short visit, lots of folks to see. And my mother and father were separated. So going to Pittsburgh meant a choice. You know, who do you spend your time with? So that was part of the motivation. There's a larger picture. My father's father was from South Carolina, Promised Land, South Carolina, a small black community near Greenwood in the Piedmont region of the state. And that is a community that was founded in the 1870s after the Civil War, one of the few places in the South where the former slaves could buy land and try to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, try to become part of the American dream. And in about 10 years, there was a thriving black community in that region, and it still exists today. Not thriving anymore, and it never really did thrive for long, because Promised Land started out on a humbug. The freedmen paid inflated prices for pretty worthless land. Anyway, but in another sense, Promised Land is a monument of persistence and family and black courage. So I wanted to know about that place. When I was a kid, my grandfather had invited me to travel there with him, but I had been educated in the North and in schools that devalued and, in fact, made fun of my past, so that I equated South Carolina with Africa. And I didn't want to go there because I didn't want to be associated with watermelon and real black people and women smoking pipes and slaves. And that was my image. And I didn't want to go there. I wanted to stay in Pittsburgh during the summer. So I never got to make that trip. So I never got to meet my grandfather's people. I never got to meet my people. I never got to see how that place connected me. And so once on one of these trips to Pittsburgh, I decided that I'd ask my father if he wanted to go back to Promised Land, a place he'd only seen twice, once when he was a boy, 5, 6 years old, and once when he was in the Army in 1942. So I just asked him, you want to go back to Promised Land? And I had lots of subtext and lots of plans, but really the most important thing was to take this trip with him, because I had never remembered spending more than an hour or so, the two of us together alone, doing anything my whole life. So that trip south is the spine of the book, and spinning out of that are essays, the past, the present, and it became a meditation, of course, as you might have guessed from what I'm saying, also a meditation on race. So the book is allowing me to address a very personal issues. It's allowing me to think about some of the things that are happening in America right now, fathers and sons and orphans and all that kind of stuff.
I want to know what happened when you got to Promised Land. Now. Now. I do. I used to have a file cabinet that whenever I got upset about something or confused or if I saw something I thought was just outrageous, I'd write it down and make a little tab on a little Pendiflex file, and it was like novel number 2, novel number 3, story number 10, you know. I had 90 stories once, little paragraphs, little, you know, in this file, and I had pink, yellow, red. It was beautiful. Never finished any of them. Go back and look at them and realize that your attitude or my attitude had changed, that it wasn't so much the things that I cared about then I no longer cared about, but it was like I sort of resolved them for some reason, and the immediacy was gone. So I've sort of learned that deal with it right now before you lose it. And fortunately and unfortunately, sometimes I do that too many areas of my life. But in this case, after Waiting to Exhale was published, and more people than I ever dreamed read that book, I sort of got blocked, which I used to always talk to my students about, that, you know, writer's block is just a very personal form of constipation that you impose on yourself, you know, and that really it was bull. That if you cared about anything, there's no reason you couldn't express it, you know. And I forgot about that for about a year and a half, because I'd sort of sit there and I start thinking that. You know, and I'd always told my students, you know, don't ever think about your audience. If you do that, you know, they'll be sitting on your shoulder watching every word that you write, and you won't be able to write. Well, the past year and a half, millions of people have been in my study with me, saying, don't even think about it. That is like so tacky, Terry. Nobody will really care. You can't write. You used to have an imagination. It's gone. You know, I mean, I'm serious. I am serious. You know, if you write that, they're going to think it's your sister, you know, or that will embarrass so-and-so. So it's like, you know, a year and a half went by. And then my mother died. And it sort of brought me back alive again. It's really kind of weird. I don't know how that works. But, and I almost think she knew it, because she used to always say to me over this past year and a half, as she spent quite a bit of the money I got from Waiting to Exhale joyously, Terry, I don't hear that computer like I used to, you know? Because she'd visit me and she'd say, gotta get that next book contract. And I already bought her a Lexus. Now she wants a phone in it. So it's like, hey, new book contract, bigger car. You know? Not really, but, you know, she was worried why she never heard me pecking away in there in the mornings. And I had had an idea for, before I finished Waiting to Exhale, I knew what my next book was going to be about. I was going to write a story about two brothers in prison. One brother was in prison. The other brother killed his brother for something really stupid. And I was interested in showing how sometimes I was curious about how a lot of young men end up, black men, end up in prison. And sometimes for the wrong reasons, sometimes for reasons that they can't help. I was really curious because there are a lot of young men in prison who aren't criminals. And I know a lot of them. There are some that are criminals. But I was curious about the ones who aren't. And so I wanted to explore that. But over the course of a year and a half, I got really scared, and I didn't feel qualified to go inside of their heads and really explore that. The bottom line was that in addition to being scared, I really just got lazy, and I didn't feel like expending the energy. And then again, when my mom died, you know, there have been a lot of other things going on in my family and people just telling me things that... It occurred to me that part of what I wanted to do with the young men from prison was I was curious about how, if they had what I thought were good parents, which a lot of sometimes kids do, how some can go one way and some can go another way. And after I sort of shelved it, I realized that what still concerned me was how you can have a household, say 4 or 5 kids, and everybody turns out differently. I mean, one can be very egocentric, selfish, loving, warm. One can be a victim, you know. I mean, we could come up with the whole list. But the other thing I was interested in is what happens as a parent of adult children when some of your kids basically are f-ups, and when you're disappointed in them. What do you do? How do you express that? And I realized that, you know, when you're a parent, and I'm a parent, that your kids, you know, a lot of times the first, after, you know, 8 or 9 years, the first thing you think of is, oh, 8, 10 years left, and they're out, they're gone, I don't have to worry about them. And I found out from my own mother and just watching other parents, that is not true. Once you are a parent, you are always a parent. You don't stop. And I realized that because my mother worried about me and my sisters and brother. And I wanted to explore that. You know, what happens when your kids don't live up to your expectations? Realistically, and what happens when you really want the best for someone, particularly your own children, and when you see them doing things that you know will hurt and harm them, you know, how do you handle that? And also, from the kids' perspective, how do you keep your parents out of your life? You know, and help them to stop passing judgment on you, you know? It's like, because it's a two-way street. You know, I mean, my mother being gone, it's like even though she knew that I hated advice, I mean, she got on my nerves. She really got on my nerves. And you know you did, Mama, and I love you. But now, even though I rarely took her advice, I miss not hearing it. I really miss her telling me what she thinks I should be doing, you know? And there's a lot to be said for that. And I do it to my kid now. So that's basically And also, you know, I'm curious about men who go through a midlife crisis, and I want to see what can happen in a household when a man goes through a midlife crisis and the woman's going through menopause at the same time. I'm serious. And also, how adult children handle a divorce of their parents who's been married for centuries. I want to know what that's like. So I'm going to give these people a whole lot of problems. And, but I want to have some fun at the same time. I mean, that's my thing. I have to enjoy myself. I have to really like the people that I write about, even though I may not agree with their behavior. I want to, I'm not saying it to be funny either. I've never been through menopause. I mean, my days are numbered, but I know a lot of, I want to know what it's like, and I can find out what it's like by writing about it if I let myself go that far, and I have to. And I want to know what men go through when they go through midlife crises. And I've seen the behavior of some men. And also, I want to know what happens when people are older and they really are sick of each other. When
get married.
Well, you know, Viola here has been married to Cecil for 38 years. But I think she's driven him out of the house. I think. I don't know yet. I'll find out. But part of the beauty of this for me is, you get to a certain point where, I mean, it's like you have to fall. You have to allow yourself to really just fall. Or surrender is the word I like to use. And I think that for that year and a half, my life changed so dramatically, professionally, in a whole lot of different ways. And I wasn't really, I don't think, emotionally or mentally prepared for it. And I wasn't going to be beaten down by it, even though I did get beaten down by it, because I didn't really want to buy into all of the hype of being the best-selling author, you know, and all this stuff. Because what is more interesting to me is the writing process. I mean, you write and you want people to read your work and you want people to like it. I mean, every writer does. Every writer does. But to have the numbers that read this book, it was overwhelming. And I'm not complaining about that, but there's a lot of stuff that comes with it that you don't anticipate that affected my work, and I wasn't used to that, you know, from people wanting money. A lot of people want money. And your time. I mean, a lot of demands made on your time, and everybody wants you to represent their cause and be their spokesperson, and it just gets really crazy. And as a result, I found myself being really wiped out, and I was so self-absorbed with Terry, the persona almost, you know, that I didn't have what I feel like what John was just, I didn't have as much empathy or compassion left. I was thinking about this today in the hotel. I know what happened. I felt like, you know those Nintendo games when they play them and the character like loses energy? You've seen it when they lose energy? It just keeps disappearing and disappearing, and then when there's no energy, the character's dead, but they always get more energy. But I was like one of those Super Mario. It was like, you know, my buttons had been, I'd been doing like this, jumping and flying and stuff, and then all of a sudden I was just like, and it took a while to replenish. And I have to basically thank my mother for that. I think she knew what she was doing in some ways. Because her death brought me back from what I think of as being emotionally dead. And if you're in that state, I don't think you can write. And if you don't feel, if you can't step out of your own world, which I was having a hard time doing, there's no way I could have any compassion or empathy for anybody else.
I once wrote in one of my journals, which served me as kind of places to talk to myself. I once wrote, I write because I'm lonely and there's no one to talk to. And that, and I read it later, and it sounded like pretty whiny.
It is whiny.
Whiny, kind of sad. But it also sounded right. Not that I wanted somebody's shoulder to cry on, but then I realized, sort of between the lines, what I was trying to say to myself, that when something's really important, when there's not a way to remove it in a simple way, whether it's death or loss or great happiness or whatever, it wouldn't matter if all my friends were in the room. My mother and father, it wouldn't matter. Because that language, the things you could say to me if you were my best friend, are irrelevant. They'll just bounce off. And all of us know that if you've ever tried to console a friend, and particularly if you've tried to console a child, your child. And what I was getting at is that the language you try to make, or the language you try to create when you are a fiction writer or poet, is of a totally different order. And it has that capacity to at least offer the possibility of filling up that space that is a sort of existential or inconsolable, unconsolable loneliness. You're born alone, and you go out alone. And it's that self that I think I needed to speak to. And the only language I found that I can use to reach that self is the writing that I do. So I guess what I'm saying is the main reason I write is to try to understand the world. And to understand the world in terms of cultivating my imagination. We talked a lot about imagination last night and the political dimensions of it, artistic dimensions, but it's still a concept and an idea that I come back to again and again, because I feel that the worst thing that's happening in our country is our failure of imagination, our inability to, our collective inability to get inside one another's skins. And that follows from our history, from the fact that, from the history of slavery, the history of inequality. We don't want to think about that too much. We'd rather float all sorts of myths that explain away our inconsistency and our inhumanity. And so memory and imagination are rather dangerous, because they say, look at yourself, think about yourself. They say, don't accept the pat answer, but try to figure out in your own terms what's bothering you. So if you have some great fear, and somebody tells you, oh, you know why you're afraid? You know why you're unhappy? It's because black people are moving in your block. Or it's because women want to take your job. Or it's because North Korea has the atom bomb. You know, all those things are pretty frightening, but how real are they? And is that really what worries you? Is that really where the fear and the unhappiness and the lack of connection is coming from? And if not, are we sustaining the capacity to consult our history and make up stories other than the crap stories that get passed off as reality? Because after all, what does fiction do? It creates a version of reality. a version of reality. And it is subversive. It can be subversive. It can also be a kind of stimulation and reinforcement of the status quo. And that's what popular fiction is, I think, because it's a no-brainer. There are nothing a no-brainer. There's nothing being called into question. That's what by definition, a page turner is one that isn't going to shake you up too much. The rules are all there.
He's talking about me.
That was John Edgar Wideman and Terry McMillan speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1994. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.